Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners. It is certainly great to be back on the air with you guys. I have really missed my time being on the air with you all, but I must say that I had a great time being on assignment. How so? Well, my wife and I got to spend quality time with a dear friend of hers, whom she had not seen in nearly 5.5 years, who lives out on the West Coast in California. Not only did we get to spend time with her, but we got to take her to some unique places, most notably Colonial Williamsburg and Yorktown. And most important of all, we had a blast. We didn't miss out on anything. That's a good thing, especially when it comes to getting together with friends. No matter how long it's been since you saw them last, the most important thing is to not miss out on quality time spent. Now, I certainly have missed being on the air with you guys, but one thing I do know is that during the time that I was away, I was able to prepare for when I was going to be on the air next, and what do you know? I had time to be on the air sooner than I thought I would be. I didn't think I'd be on the air until tomorrow at earliest. But I'm on the air now, and I am seizing the opportunity to make the most out of it. I also know that lately there have been a lot of things that have taken, not so much have taken place, but I do know that back on Monday of this week marked the 112th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. Why should that matter? Well, when the Titanic was being built, she was supposed to be grand. And she was grand. Not only was she grand, but everybody deemed her as unsinkable, especially those within the shipping industry. She was just the newest, the latest, the most top of the line movable object that could transport thousands of people. And when I mean by thousands, I'm not talking 10,000 people, but just around between 1,500 and 2,000 people from points A to B to the final destination. Luxury travel. First class, I mean, it's not Royal Caribbean, but everybody thought this ship was invincible, that this ship could not run into anything that would disrupt her her travel, that would disrupt her goals. Well, sadly, on the night of April 14th, 1912, all that changed. Titanic struck an iceberg. An iceberg that whose size was underestimated, an iceberg that did a lot of damage to where over a 2.5 hour span, the ship sank. 1,500 people perished. 1,500 men, women, and children from all different classes, first, second, third, 705 people survived. And their lives were changed forever. It's been 112 years since Titanic sank, but we're still being reminded to this day that man is not the most powerful element on this earth. Mother Nature is the most powerful element on this earth. Mother Nature gets the final say. And too often we forget that Mother Nature is going to prevail over mankind. So, while we are constantly learning something new about Titanic, whether it's through reading a book about the infamous ship or watching a documentary, we must be reminded that whatever happened on the evening of April 14th to the 15th of 1912 should still serve as a reminder 112 years later, because Titanic still has secrets to reveal. Titanic might still be around as a ship. Yes, she could be eroding or corroding very rapidly due to the Titanica rusticles, but she still has stories to tell. Yes, there will always be controversies over whether or not to bring up items from the ship, given that it is a graveyard. But the items that have been brought up certainly have told a story. The bigger question is, it's up to us as to how we value those stories. Do we value them from the heart, or should we be valuing them for profit purposes? Well, I think we should be valuing them from the heart. If we value the stories for profit, then all we're doing is chasing the almighty dollar. Too often, if we're not careful, the almighty dollar gets in the way of the morals to stories. Well, I do have some breaking news to report. Breaking news is that we are still at it with the frozen water trade, how ice from New England lakes kept the world cool by Gavin Waitman. And not only are we still at it, but with this podcast segment episode to this book, we're going to be learning how Frederick Tudor reinvents certain things with regards to his ice trade. In other words, we're going to learn how he reinvents shipping ice to places in the Caribbean or the West Indies where he had first begun this, endeavor that had been scoffed upon by many within the inner circle. But we will also learn where he goes domestically in terms of southern cities and where he ultimately finds success. So I think it's fair to say that we probably should get the show on the road, given that we have 6 pages of information to cover before time itself slips away. So here we go, folks, with our first leadoff question for this podcast segment episode to the frozen water trade. Did Frederick Tudor's ship, the Milo, arrive into Charleston, South Carolina prior to 1816 coming to an end? Yes, Frederick came into Charleston on board the Milo 1 week after departing Boston from November 1st. Wow, talk about some quick transit time per early 19th century. The weather really must have been favorable to have gotten there in 1 week's time by boat. Well, you know, Charleston, South Carolina, when I think of Charleston, South Carolina, say from a colonial standpoint, leading up to the American Revolutionary War, Charleston, South Carolina was the South's biggest port city. And in the early 19th century, Charleston, South Carolina remains as a thriving port town whose merchants and planters earned their wealth from cotton and indigo. Indigo, before cotton, was really the big staple crop. And it turns out that a fellow signer of the United States Constitution, a Mr. John Rutledge, his family was responsible for getting the indigo trade started in South Carolina, most notably around Charleston. So whenever you hear of indigo, think of John Rutledge, and I should say the Rutledge family. So when Frederick Tudor arrives into Charleston, South Carolina, he's convinced right away that he could raise anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 through making advance payments, resulting in the building of a large ice house, to placing ice on the market at a very low price, or I should say at low prices. Well, Frederick does get set up with a high-profile lawyer in Charleston named Langdon Cheves, or Langdon Cheves, C-H-E-V-S. So Langdon Cheves is a lawyer with top-level connections amongst the South Carolina state politicians. Well, it's one thing to get set up with a lawyer, but if you have a lawyer who has top-level connections amongst many within the South Carolina state legislature, that is an even bigger advantage, because regardless of the party, you are regardless of, say, which political party could be in power in the state legislature, and even for the party that's in the minority, regardless of what connections you make, these connections carry weight. These connections carry not just weight itself, but weight that should be for the better. But at the same time, you also don't want to do anything that would upset the politicians to where a deal itself does not go through. You want to come away with something. Coming away with something should be better than nothing. Langdon Chavez instructed Frederick to stick with seeking the monopoly request instead of raising $5,000 to $10,000 through making advance payments. Why do you think it would have been necessary for Frederick to stick to seeking the monopoly? Well, by seeking the monopoly request for the overall supply of ice, this means that, yes, he could still have contact with politicians on the state level, but he also could come into contact with merchants. Merchants, yes, say within Charleston itself, but merchants outside of Charleston whom also have relationships with merchants within greater Charleston. So, in other words, the network should be a little bit broader, but the network should not be one that's too complicated to where, you know, you might be able to raise $1,000 to $2,000 in a short period of time, but if you can't raise $10,000 within a month's time frame, then how are you going to be able to make advance payments long term to where you ultimately get what you want? So Frederick is going to have to reinvent some things here. So he does come into contact with Samuel Davenport, who just so happens to be a Bostonian merchant who is on business in Charleston. He went along with the deal proposal that would allow Frederick himself to have the monopoly. That is, if this monopoly goes through. Now, prior to 1816's ending, Frederick went to the South Carolina State Capitol of Columbia to pitch the monopoly request. You know, it's interesting how you know, we learned early on that Frederick, when he was in Massachusetts, how he spoke with the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, Harrison Gray Otis, about the idea of getting a monopoly through Congress and also, you know, trying to get this ice trade going. And as we learned, that Harrison Gray Otis liked the idea of transporting a commodity being ice, but Harrison Gray Otis didn't go along with it because he didn't want to invest his money in something that was risky, and it was also an endeavor that had not been tried before. And also knowing that we could be loading cargo onto a vessel that is melting, and who's to say by the time it arrives to its final destination that there will be any cargo left. In other words, you know, for Harrison Gray Otis, he didn't want to be losing money. He wanted to be obviously making money, but knowing that this endeavor had not been experimented with before, and knowing that there hadn't been any positive results before, you know, I know, hey, I should not be investing in this, so therefore I'm out, like they say on Shark Tank. So anyways, when Frederick Tudor went to the South Carolina State Capitol of Columbia to pitch this monopoly request, the monopoly issue itself caused great political tension amongst the legislators in South Carolina. However, you know, Frederick isn't going to be deterred by this. So what does he do instead? He moved forward in early 1817 by having carpenters from Boston begin work on an ice house in Charleston. In other words, he brings down a crew of workers from Boston And he proves to these South Carolinians in the state legislature that, hey, look, I know a monopoly seems risky, but I can also take things up a notch by proving to you all that I have the manpower to build you all an ice house. I also have the manpower to be able to prove to you all that I can send ships down here with ice, and that we as a team, being I myself and the carpenters, will be able to prove to you all that we have the proper means of putting in the insulation that will preserve this ice, not just for short-term purposes, but for long-term as well. So this way you do have a commodity that is profitable, a commodity that will preserve beverages and food long-term. Because think about it, folks. As we all know, by this point in time, the only people who have access to ice houses are those whom are wealthy, those whom have the means to be able to preserve foods from a luxury standpoint on a long-term basis. People from other ranks, say from middling families, they may have means of preserving food, but maybe not an ice house. You have an ice house, you really are moving on up. It's, you know, talk of town of sorts, let's put it that way. And, you know, we do have to be reminded of the fact that Charleston, South Carolina was the capital of South Carolina up until about 1790, and that's when it was relocated further inland into Columbia. Before 1816 ended, what did Frederick himself begin selling to Charleston, South Carolina families? Yes, folks, believe it or not, breaking news, we, you know, when we hear this term or this item or device, whatever you want to call it, we think of it as in modern day times, but Frederick made what was called a domestic refrigerators, or what we call ice boxes, little ice houses. How about that? These little ice houses were wooden boxes with insulation and inner lining of iron, designed to hold daily sums of up to 3 pounds of ice, which sought to chill beverages. It was also used for ice cream making to preserving fresh fruits. So there again, if you have an ice house, you are obviously in the upper tiers of society, and you're using these ice houses and these little ice, or what we call little ice houses, for a whole host of reasons. Yeah, you could be showing off your wealth, but you are showing others that, hey, I have the means to preserve my beverages and my foods long term so that they won't perish over a short period of time. Is it fair to say that Frederick Tudor himself got accepted into Charleston society? Or I should say into Charleston, South Carolina society. Yes, he got welcomed. He got welcomed big time, folks. Most notably into the top level, being the planter class, given that his family contacts, let's put it that way, and consistent abilities to supply ice had paid off long term. Well, Frederick had proven not only to the state politicians in South Carolina, but to prominent families that, hey, look, I carried out my promise. And because my promise has paid off, and we have sent now shipments to South Carolina, I've now been accepted into your all society. I may hail from up north, but I am a free. I know that I will always be welcomed back, knowing that I lived up to your all's expectations and promise. It's one thing to say, hey, I've got the means to be able to transport this stuff down your all's way. Something that some of you may have seen, but not the masses. But we do have the means to supply ice to the people of Charleston, South Carolina, which is a more tropical climate. You know, they might have some cool temperatures, but not like New England weather. But people in Charleston, South Carolina would kill to have ice. They would kill to have ice to preserve their food and beverages for longer periods of time within a year's time frame. Well, in the midst of success with ice shipments to Charleston, South Carolina, Frederick set his eyes next on Savannah, Georgia. Well, you know, when I think of Georgia, you know, Georgia was the last of the original 13 colonies to be established. Well, Georgia, folks, was established in the year 1733. That was the year after George Washington was born in 1732, 2 years before John Adams would be born in 1735. So Georgia, folks, 1733. Jamestown, Virginia, which was the first permanent English settlement in the New World in 1607. So from the time the English established their first permanent settlement in the New World in 1607 to the last of the original 13 colonies to be established in the year 1733, we're looking at a time period of over 126 years. So Georgia was the last of the original 13 colonies, yes, to be established, but the first to have been established in the 18th century. All the other 12 colonies, folks, from New Hampshire down to North Carolina to South Carolina, were all established in the 17th century. So I just think it's very unique for Georgia. Of course, Georgia was the most remote to the 13 colonies. But when she was established in the year 1733, she was set up by Englishman James Edward Oglethorpe. There is a college outside of Atlanta known as Oglethorpe University, which would be named after James Edward Oglethorpe. Now, in the 1820s, during the 1820s, Savannah, Georgia, Savannah is thriving, most notably from exporting cotton domestically to various parts of the United States, but internationally at high levels. Now, of course, when we think of Georgia, we always tend to think of Atlanta. And yes, Atlanta is the capital of Georgia, but in colonial times, folks, there was no such thing as Atlanta. You've got Savannah as your capital. And a city north of Savannah, which also Savannah borders South Carolina. Another city to the north of Savannah that has been around since colonial times and also borders South Carolina is Augusta. Of course, when I think of Augusta, Georgia, the first thing that comes to my mind is the Masters Golf Tournament, which recently took place the other week. So those are the two cities that I think of when I think of Georgia in colonial times, are Savannah and Augusta. So yes, Frederick has his eyes set on going next into Savannah, Georgia. He's still going to keep the business in Charleston, but he wants to expand. He's on a good roll here, folks. He's experienced his shares of lows, but he has experienced some incredible highs. So after arriving into Savannah late summer of 1817, Frederick has discovered that the interest levels for ice are high. That's a good thing, but here's the challenge, rather. Come summertime, for those living in Savannah, one group of people are usually not in town during summertime, and that's the wealthy. Why aren't the wealthy in town, or I should say in the heart of Savannah, during the summertime? They are escaping the city due to oppressive heat. So they want to be where it's a little bit cooler. They're not going to be prone to diseases like yellow fever. They're going to be immune from not getting exposed to the presence of mosquitoes that could a whole slew of mosquitoes that could be swarming around the swamps. And when mosquitoes are known to swarm around the swamps, that's when they can pose as a problem. So for the wealthy, they want to get as far away from the oppressive heat as possible. So this way, their quality of life is a little bit more modified. They'll come back into the heart of Savannah when it's not so warm. So therefore, Frederick sees that if that's one disadvantage, here's another. If the wealthy are all away due to the oppressive heat, Frederick himself is unable to raise money for ice house construction. Well, you know, given he's had so much success in Charleston, South Carolina, did Frederick himself fear returning back to Boston? Yeah, he did. He truly did. He, for one, he didn't have much money. And secondly, coming home to Boston risked serving jail time for all debts still outstanding. So yeah, if you come back on your own home soil and they catch you, the authorities do, or the constables, the debt collectors, you're going to be in jail. We're not talking maybe like 5 days or a week. We could be looking at months. Because he, you know, when I was on the air last time with you guys, I think we learned that Frederick had four outstanding debts against him that he had not paid. I mean, he wasn't trying to be ignorant, but here he is trying to make a decent living for his family, given that his family is struggling to stay afloat. Matter of fact, I can mention some of that to you all here just now. I'll tell you all here now. Frederick's family is nearly destitute by this point in time. Another word for poor. They have, you know, they were in the high, you know, being part of the inner circle, the Brahmin elite. But now they have fallen out of social grace. Frederick's father is currently living in a district of Boston considered undesirable on a lower tier salary, something that the Brahmins would frown upon. Frederick had a falling out with brother William, whom sought a literary career in Boston by editing the North American Review. His younger brother Harry focused on cards, including drinking. I tell you, sometimes we make choices that aren't always for the better, but I also have to believe that maybe, just maybe, there might be one or two of Frederick's family members who might be willing to help themselves, might be willing to turn their life around to where they might come around when Frederick least might least expect it to where if his business is having a rough patch in the road, that family will turn around and help things get back on track. Well, Frederick is one of those individuals whom had, sadly, he had few friends, but he had more enemies. He was always in search for trustworthy people. But when he found trustworthy people, they either let him down, or they passed away, or they sought to take more than their fair share of the profits. In other words, yes, everybody wants to contribute. Everybody wants to have a helping hand. But sometimes business partners want more than what should be asked. In other words, yes, we all want a part of something. But if we're not the head honcho who got this started, then maybe we need to let the head honcho be the one to tell us what we should be entitled to. As much as we'd like to think that even sometimes that alone works out for the better, sometimes it doesn't. But for Frederick Tudor, it's always been a struggle. Who deserves to have their fair share of the profits? But the bigger question is, whom can I trust and whom can I not trust? It's a never-ending cycle, to say the least. Come December of 1817, what did Frederick himself record per his first ever ice house diary that he had started making notes in years before? But in December of 1817, he recorded something of a first that he had not ever mentioned before. Think about it here for just a moment while I have a sip of water to keep myself awake. Hang tight. Okay, I'm back on. Well, Frederick had to make a note. He made a note that every few years, or from time to time, there would come upon a winter that would be considered as warm or mild, where there would still be ice, but there wouldn't be enough ice available to harvest for a full cargo load in terms of where its final destination or endpoint would ultimately go to. So, come the year of 1818, there was a presence of modified cargo, or I should say ice loads, sent from Boston to Havana, Cuba, only for the ship's Luna to get dismasted, including Cicero, get wrecked. Unfortunately, in the year 1818, no profits from Havana, Cuba, surfaced. And ice itself, believe it or not, folks, ran out altogether. This is a crisis. I mean, it's not a full-scale crisis, but it's a crisis that Frederick Tudor has never dealt with before. I mean, he has dealt with some unique firsts before that some have been for the better. There have been some that have not been for the better. Of course, we learned early on about that first shipment of ice into St. Pierre, Martinique, where a good majority of the ice had melted. And yes, he made $2,000, but we learned that he should have taken that $4,000 that was given to him. But of course, you know, even 13 some years later, is he still learning all the trials and errors that go along with shipping ice? Yes. Is he in a better place than he was than compared to when he started in early 1806? Yes. But he's still got some challenges that lie ahead. But would Frederick himself pursue shipping ice directly to Savannah, Georgia after 1818? Yes. For starters, come January 1819, Frederick had 30 workmen under his belt whom constructed an ice house with a capacity of 12,000 to 13,000 square feet, resulting in holding over 200 tons of ice. Secondly, come February of 1819, the official ice trade into Savannah began with an inaugural load transporting 160 tons. Well, this is all good news. It's definitely another big step in the right direction from a domestic standpoint in terms of transporting a commodity that had never been transported by anyone else before in the United States. Frederick, if you were in his shoes and you had to prefer one over the other in terms of cities, and your choices were Charleston, South Carolina, or Savannah, Georgia, which of the two cities did Frederick prefer? He favored Charleston over Savannah, but he was greatly pleased by how the people of Savannah, Georgia benefited from the ice cargo shipment. Success in Savannah led to the sudden market expansion for ice outside the city, most notably Augusta and Darien, which one could get which one could get to by riverboat. Hey, good means of a transportation access, that is. Frederick departed Savannah on July 4th of 1819. Wow, to think the United States is 43 years old on July 4th, 1819. He returned to Boston with good news, a lot of good news to report, to say the least. Frederick doesn't know of this, and he won't know of it until after he officially arrives back into Boston, but sadly, on July 8th of 1819, his father died. But Frederick himself is unaware of the family member's death until arriving back home in late July, or come early August. You know, early on, we had learned that Frederick's father was skeptical of this business that Frederick sought to pursue. He was skeptical of it because it's not that he didn't love his son. He just didn't want to see his son waste away a fortune where it could lead to further negative repercussions, such as spending frequent time in jail just because, you know, you would be unable to pay off a debt or multiple debts, or be in a situation where the inner circle would scoff at you and say that you are wasting money from within when you should be using the money wisely for business endeavors that are far more relevant. Well, when Frederick arrived back, yes, he was very saddened by his father's passing. He had no ill will or no ill feelings towards his father. And I think that's good to know that even though, yes, his father may have been skeptical of this business endeavor, at least, you know, we know that Frederick, I think it's fair to say that Frederick did part on good terms with his dad. Not everybody, you know, gets to do that with a loved one. There are a variety of reasons for it. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a therapist. But it's just one of those situations that we have to be reminded of, that even 200 years ago, you know, think about it, we there are no telephones, so we have no way of knowing right away that that a loved one has died. But it is fair to say that Frederick knew that he had a great relationship with his father. We can say that he that despite their differences, they still managed to still have a good connection with one another. And that's what counts when it's all said and done with. Did Frederick take it upon himself to restore markets which had not performed well in years past? Yes, indeed. Most notably in Martinique and Guadeloupe, given their existing monopolies had expired. So, who can Frederick turn to help modify these existing markets where their monopolies had expired, being in Martinique and Guadeloupe? He turns to Stephen Cabot, who is the son of a wealthy Boston family whom had journeyed to France and ultimately prevailed in renewing the ice trade monopoly for Martinique and Guadeloupe. In late March of 1819, the first cargo of ice entered into Saint-Pierre, and sales were successful to where an eventual second load went out. I tell you, it does take the right person to be able to re-energize an endeavor that, say, had not done well years earlier, but now all of a sudden it's back on the right track. Well, what came about in July 1819, being the same month Frederick himself came home from Savannah? Well, how ironic, folks, that Boston, Massachusetts is experiencing a shortage of ice stores, which meant that places like Saint-Pierre, Martinique, had potential likelihood of seeing their business ventures come apart. If you have a shortage of ice stores, that means you're going to have a hard time being able to find places to store greater bulk quantities of ice, because if you don't have the means of storing the ice, then how is the ice going to stay intact? How is it going to stay preserved? You know, it's not like I can just call up a truck and say, "Hey, where do you have? Do we have any temperature controlled vehicles here that we can place this ice in to keep it frozen so that it doesn't melt?" We don't have that kind of sophisticated refrigeration means in terms of transportation. But the bigger question is how are we going to modify this? Well, one solution for acquiring ice came in the form of icebergs. Well, Massachusetts isn't anywhere near icebergs. But what I do know about icebergs are that they are pieces of freshwater ice, that is, which are more than 15 meters long. And they, being that they are pieces of freshwater ice, they have broken off of a glacier or ice shelf, and they ultimately float freely in open water, aka salt water. Every spring, big chunks or pieces from the Arctic Circle break away from the ice sheet and float south, posing hazards to shipping. Well, isn't that what the Titanic folks ultimately encountered? Well, what I do know, and I remember when we talked about the podcast series about the Titanic and how the night that the Titanic went down, and also involving the Carpathia and the Californian, and the night that the Titanic went down, I think it was called The Other Side of the Night. But anyways, the winter of 1911 and 1912 was a very mild winter. And because it was so mild, there were greater numbers of big chunks or pieces that broke away from glaciers from the Arctic Circle that came down further south, unlike never before. And long story short, historians know that the iceberg that floated further south had been coming apart for some time. They know that it might have started to have come apart as early as 1908, but over time, especially by 1911, 1912, as the winter got very mild, that iceberg moved a lot faster and made its way further south than originally most people would have ever assumed that it would have gone. But long story short, that's what ultimately brought the Titanic down, was because of encountering icebergs in places that they had never really been accustomed to seeing icebergs go in terms of a further southerly route. But anyways, in terms of the solution for acquiring ice via the form of icebergs, Stephen Cabot modified the shortage situation by having Captain Hadlock and his crew go north, where they broke off sections of icebergs, which rescued outstanding business operations in Martinique. Quite a risky adventure to break off sections of icebergs, especially knowing that the worst parts of the icebergs lie at the bottom, lie underneath the surface. And that's what the Titanic didn't realize, was that the worst part of the iceberg, usually about 90% of an iceberg, is invisible. And of course, historians know, had the Titanic just hit the iceberg straight on, she would have remained afloat. Yeah, she would have sustained damage, but she would have remained afloat. She would never have sunk. So anyways, Frederick Tudor and Stephen Cabot, what's interesting is that while, yes, they did have a working relationship, but they didn't see eye to eye on all things, which over time led to signs of potential fallout. And over time, Frederick Tudor sought to go to New Orleans, Louisiana as his next spot for further market expansion, but his brother Harry got his act together and would ultimately become responsible for success in the New Orleans, ice shipping expansion. Besides Frederick's return to Boston from Havana in 1823, now we're into the early 1820s, what unique first took place in Boston come summer of the same year? Well, for starters, steamboat service. That's right, folks. Steamboat service transit began from Boston to an island called Nahant. N-A-H-A-N-T. Nahant. Some people may say Nahant. I'm going to say it as Nahant. Nahant was located in the Massachusetts Bay, 12 miles north of Boston. Now, prior to 1823, Nahant served as a place for the Bostonians to picnic and stay. But by 1823, a hotel was built at Nahant and soon became the top spot for wealthy Bostonians to vacation during the summer. Now, remember, Frederick and his family had a place called Rockwood where they would go to escape the heat from the heart of Boston. And that's where Frederick and his family had had an ice house. And that's what ultimately inspired him to want to expand upon this trade. In other words, let's not have the ice completely thaw, but let's find ways to cut the ice from the pond so we can ship it not just from Rockwood, but other ponds and rivers, lakes, but transport this stuff down to tropical climates where, for one, it's not going to waste, and two, people in places where we would never expect before would kill to have a commodity that we here up north, yes, we have it, but yet we take it for granted. So, Rockwood, though, long story short, got sold. It was sold for debt payment purposes, but Frederick, given with all of the success he's had now, he has laid out plans for Nahant to replace Rockwood as the new family getaway estate. And by summer of 1825, Frederick's family as a whole, the Tudor family, begins vacationing at Nahant. Well, what a great way to reinvent the wheel there in terms of taking a place that many would say is desolate, rural, but we know that it's got great advantages for those who can afford to go. Well, does anybody know who Nathaniel Wyeth is? He just so happens to be one of Frederick's ice suppliers whom, like Frederick, did not attend Harvard, but yet came from a well-to-do family whose father owned a hotel in Cambridge on the shores of Fresh Pond. Come 1825, Nathaniel Wyeth came to an idea behind finding better methods of cutting ice. Wyeth proposed an idea, and this is a radical one, folks, but it's got a lot of merit. Wyeth proposed the idea where horses got harnessed to a metal blade, resulting in cutting ice while dragged over Fresh Pond's surface. How about that, folks? And a proposal to where horses are going to be getting harnessed to a metal blade that would result in the horses cutting ice while they are being dragged over Fresh Pond's surface. Now, we did learn earlier that a unique first had taken place in Boston come summer of 1823, and that we have steamboat service transit. So, of course, with a steamboat, you have a steam engine. And in 1825, yes, steam engines were propelling multiple types of machinery. But if there's one thing they can't do in terms of disadvantage is that they are not doable for ice cutting. How so? Well, steam engines are heavy. And who's to say that if you place a steam engine on one of these, what do you call it? A horse plow. Who's to say that the horses are not going to remain stable? In other words, are the horses going to be frightened by the power of the steam engine? Is the steam engine going to come apart while the horse plow is in transit? It's a bold idea, but it's also not something that is compatible just yet at this time, primarily because horses, folks, throughout the 19th century, horses are a vital source of transportation and also for motive power purposes. Horses drove all road vehicles, hauling farm machinery to distributing goods into towns coming off the canal boats, most notably the Erie Canal, including ships, trains. Of course, railroads over time will replace canals. But horses, folks, I mean, they serve more of a purpose than just being on a farm. But Wyeth is credited for inventing the horse-drawn ice plow, which cut deep grooves into surfaces of frozen ponds. One man would walk beside the horse to keep the device in a straight line, while a second man followed behind the horse and held the handles of the plow. Wow, a two-man team while assisting the horses. It doesn't get any more revolutionary than that. Now, what advantages came from Nathaniel Wyeth's new ice plow? Well, for one, cutting the ice itself was faster, which meant greater quantities could be gathered during favorable weather conditions. Secondly, a horse-drawn ice plow served as a new form of broader mass production, which led to ice reduction costs. So think about it, folks. If you've got a couple of men, you got a horse, all working together at the same time, being able to cut these grooves in a unique line to where each ice block that gets cut is going to be in the same uniform shape as the other. Yeah, you have found a great way to reduce some costs. And large plowed ice cubes resulted in being more even versus those cut by hand, along with getting placed more efficiently in ice houses to the ship's cargo holds, thus ultimately reduced the speed of overall melting. So when you can do things better and you have the right equipment and the right team, then not only have you done something revolutionary, but you have also not only reduced the costs, but you have most importantly found a mechanism for reducing the speed of overall melting. It's one thing to have melt, but if you can reduce the overall speed of melting, whether you're sending that ice to another port, say down south, or another point down south from a domestic standpoint, including international, you have proven to the end receiver that, hey, not only do you know what you're doing, but the end product is still going to arrive to you. It's going to arrive to you in a it's going to arrive to you intact. It's going to arrive to you intact to where you can still enjoy it, not just short term, but for good long term use. Now, what's interesting about this invention of Nathaniel Wyeth's, the ice plow, is that in the year 1829, his invention, he got granted a patent for the horse-drawn farmer's plow and carpenter's plane plow. Well, for Nathaniel Wyeth, he had proven that ice itself could get mined and gathered in large numbers. Whereas Frederick Tudor demonstrated that ice itself could be stored, not only could it be stored, but it could be shipped and sold from long distances where it first originated. Both men, folks, have achieved some large steps for mankind in the early part. We're not even halfway through the 19th century just yet, but they have taken some radical moves, to say the least, and it has proven successful. Now, here is another case of challenges for Frederick Tudor. One that he's already seen one, but he's going to see another. But he will live to see some other ones come along as time goes by in general. Now, we go to the winter of 1827-1828. What's interesting about this particular winter? How could it be best described? Well, it's a winter that began well come early November with cold snaps, including a strong freezing weather by early December. But late December 1827 into January 1828 saw frequent temperature fluctuations occur, which impacted overall ice thickness. So we've got to look at some numerical factors here. How is Frederick Tudor going to modify things, given that January 1828, he is seeing some radical temperature fluctuations occurring? Well, if the ice is at 6 inches thick, Frederick has decided that the ice itself at 6 inches thick will be designed for local use. If it can get to over 6 inches thick, then it will be suited for export purposes. I think it's fair to say that if your ice is going to be over 6 inches thick and you want to send it, say, to somewhere in the West Indies, then yeah, you want to send that ice. If it's under 6 inches or right at the 6-inch threshold for thickness, then we're going to use it for local purposes. We can supply it to, say, a local butcher so that he can use that ice to preserve his meat. Or, for example, so December 1827, no ice is cut. Well, that's bad enough. How about the fact that ships have already been booked? Multiple ships have already been booked, and late cargo arrivals. Should there be late cargo arrivals, what is that going to mean for Frederick Tudor? He's going to have to pay out of his own pocket for compensation purposes. He'll have to compensate the owners of these other ships who have already signed on to say, hey, we'll ship out your ice. We'll take it down to Charleston, South Carolina. We'll take it to Savannah, Georgia. We'll take it to St. Pierre, Martinique. We'll take it to wherever you've sent it before and you've had success. Well, late January of 1828, Mother Nature cooperates. The weather has hardened. But Frederick wrote to Robert Gardner, his brother-in-law from Maine, requesting emergency ice supplies. Emergency ice supplies. Where? How's he going to get emergency ice supplies? Kennebec River, which is not too far from Portland, about south of Portland. When I think of Kennebec River, it's not too far from a presidential retreat that George Herbert Walker Bush, it's still in the family. Of course, he and Barbara Bush are gone, but the place was called Kennebunkport, which is not far from the Kennebec River. So Frederick Tudor ends up getting emergency ice supplies from the Kennebec River, which often froze first before Massachusetts's waters did. But here's another challenge. Their orders for ice are coming from all directions, not just to go to southern cities, but how about south into New York City, south into Philadelphia now? So with orders coming from all directions, the winter of 1827 to 1828 was one where, lakes and rivers south did not freeze. This would not be the first time, and it wouldn't be the last. But what I do know is that we are at the end of this podcast segment episode, and when I'm on the air again next, folks, we have another new destination where Frederick will be going. Let's find out about that when I'm on the air again next. Take care for now and stay safe.